What I want to do this morning in the lesson is begin a discussion about what I'm going to refer to as church polity. Now, that may seem like a weird word. The word polity itself simply means, if you look it up in Merriam-Webster's, a political organization. You can kind of hear the word politic in polity. Specifically, a form of political organization or a politically organized unit. The form of constitution of a politically organized unit, or here, this is really the part of the definition I want us to key in on. It's all the way at the very end. The form of government of a religious denomination. That's primarily the way I want to use the term, is in relationship to that last definition. Things dealing with the organization and the operation of the church. Specifically for our purposes, when I'm using that term church polity, I'm thinking about how a local congregation is organized and functions as a cohesive unit in accomplishing the work that God has entrusted to it. And I think a fitting place for us to start is by thinking about the work of the church. What exactly is the work of the church? How is the work of the church to be carried out or facilitated? Who all is to be involved in this work? Who is responsible for accomplishing the work that is given to the church to do? Let me suggest to you that there is an inherent danger in what I believe is a false and erroneous perception about the Lord's church. That the church, the Christian church, is rooted in patriarchy and is just a good old boys club. And sometimes the way it's talked about, you might think that you'd find out front that sign that the little rascals had hanging on the door of their clubhouse, you know, He-Man Woman Haters Club, women allowed, you know. The idea that the church, insofar as its function, its work, certainly its leadership, and the involvement in the work of the church, that's something that's reserved only for men. That only men are allowed to hold active roles within the church. That it's only the men who carry the responsibility for the work of the church. That it's the men and the men only who make all of the decisions, provide all of the direction, perform all of the work that is done by and within the church. I just don't think that that is in keeping with the biblical pattern. And yet I see that mindset influencing our thinking. For example, recently when we were talking about going back to distributing the emblems for the Lord's Supper and having some men come up and serve and pass those from pew to pew. It seems that that was seen as a great, maybe even a pivotal opportunity for new Christian men to get actively involved in the church and to grow in their faith and their ability to serve in the church. Now, to be clear, I am not opposed in any way to Christian men actively leading or helping to lead in the various aspects of our corporate worship service. In fact, I think that's a great thing. It's very encouraging, both as one who gets to do that and also as one who gets to witness that being done. But if growing in the Lord is dependent upon actively leading in the worship, or if active involvement in the work of the church is defined by and limited to these types of leadership roles or services in the corporate worship, then what does that say to our women? Do they have an opportunity or a chance to get actively involved in the work of the church? And if being involved is limited only to leading in the corporate worship, then is it even possible for most of us who are a part of this congregation, at least at any given time, to be actively involved in the work of the church? Because as of right now, I'm the only one who is actively leading something. And if that's what it means to be actively involved, are you guys not doing anything right now? You see the problem with that way of thinking. If growing spiritually is a contingent upon this type of involvement, then most individuals, if we're honest with ourselves, within local churches aren't growing at all. And I will be honest that this concept, this way of thinking, has influenced my own thought. I remember as a young man, as a kid, 16, 17 years old, I had just obeyed the gospel, and I was trying hard to sharpen my skills to be able to lead singing or to have the courage to get up and lead a prayer or serve at the Lord's table or maybe even present a lesson. And I can remember vividly thinking to myself, I had this analogy in my head. I was thinking, right now, I'm riding the pine. I'm sitting on the bench. I'm a reserve player. But my day will come when I'll get to have a starting position. I'll get off the bench and I'll be in the game. And as I reflect on that very immature thinking of a young man, I realize how misplaced that whole analogy is. If that analogy is true, if it takes getting actively involved in leading in the worship to be off the bench and in the game, then again, what does that say to our young ladies? What does that say to our women? You're never going to get off the bench. In fact, you're not even really on the bench. At best, you're in the stands functioning as enthusiastic spectators. And yet, I would suggest to you that that just doesn't seem to match the New Testament picture where all Christians are actively involved and engaged in the work of the church, working together to achieve collective and individual spiritual growth. I think about passages like Ephesians chapter 4, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, that clearly talk about how all of us, the whole body, with all of our individual parts, are working cohesively together to grow, to do the work of the Lord. And so this morning I'd like for us to take a step back and look at things from a biblical perspective and investigate the topic of the work of the church. And today specifically I want to look at the business of the church, that is the mission, the purpose, the function, and the carrying out of that work, and asking ourselves who's responsible for making sure this gets done. So just to be clear, I'm not going to define today what the work of the church is. Okay, or its mission or all of those goals. I'm simply asking the question, who is responsible for carrying out the work of the church? Let me suggest to you, let me just make an assertion. And then what I'll try to do is substantiate that assertion from the biblical text. But let me assert to you that it is the whole congregation who is responsible for the business of the congregation. It's not just the elders and the deacons. It's not just the men, but every single member of the group, the young and the old, the married and the single, the men and the women, all of us who are a part of this local church are each personally responsible for seeing to and carrying out the business of this local church. And I'll attempt to substantiate that to you in two ways. Today, we're going to look at the Old Testament precedent behind the New Testament pattern. And then next week, we'll come back and look at the New Testament pattern itself that I believe substantiates that assertion that I've just made. So, bear with me as we work through some texts of Scripture. First, I think this is seen in that the whole assembly of Israel was charged with carrying out the mission of Israel. For example, if we go to Exodus chapters 19 through 24, when God is bringing the nation of Israel out of Egyptian bondage and he brings them to the base of Mount Sinai where he is going to come and visit them and deliver to them his covenant, his commandments, we see that the whole nation from beginning to end is involved in this endeavor. And so, for example, in Exodus chapter 19, verses 3 and 6, when we read that Israel reached Mount Sinai and Moses delivered the message of God, he delivered it to the house of Jacob, to the sons of Israel. And that message was that if they would obey God and keep his covenant, then they, that is, all of them, would be his own people, his own possession, verse 5. And when this message was delivered, notice in verse 8 that all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And then when God prepared to actually speak to the people, he first wanted them to consecrate themselves to be ready for their direct interaction with him when he would come and charge them or deliver to them his covenant, his commandments. Notice verse 10 and 11. "The Lord also said to Moses, 'Go to the people and consecrate them today and let them wash their garments and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people.'" And we read in verse 16, when the day arrived, that it was all the people who were in the camp that trembled when they saw the presence of the Lord on the top of the mountain. And verse 17, it was all the people who Moses brought out of the camp to meet the Lord at the foot of the mountain. And then in chapter 20, after God has spoken down the mountain, the Ten Commandments to his people, we read in verse 18 that all the people perceived the thunder and the lightning and the flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. And after being asked by the people to go up and speak to God himself and relay the message of God back to the people in verse 19, when Moses returns in chapter 24 and in verse 3, we read that Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. And notice the response. All the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do." And then Moses in verse 4 writes down all the words of the Lord. And after assembling all the people together again in verse 7, it says that he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. We will be obedient." The point that I'm trying to emphasize in this text is that when God came down and gave his covenant, when he made his covenant with Israel, he made the covenant with all of Israel, with the whole nation. Not just the leaders, not just Moses, not just the priests, not just the men, with all of the people. And God expected the whole nation, every member of it, to participate in and keep the covenant. And the whole congregation agreed. They said, "All that the Lord has commanded, we will do." Another way that this is illustrated is that the whole congregation was charged with the responsibility of keeping the camp of God pure. Notice with me in Numbers chapter 5. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Numbers chapter 5. And in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper and everyone having a discharge and everyone who is unclean because of a dead person. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst." You see, God was dwelling among the people in the midst of the camp. And because God's presence was there, that camp had to remain pure and clean. So you couldn't have any leprous people. You couldn't have anybody who was unclean from anything in the midst of the camp. And the responsibility for making sure that no unclean person was in the midst of the camp was given to the whole congregation. And what's interesting to me here in verse 4 is that the sons of Israel followed the instruction that God gave. The sons of Israel did so and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord has spoken to Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did. They were faithful in carrying out this command of the Lord. In Numbers chapter 15, we have an incident where somebody is discovered violating the fourth command. They're working on the Sabbath day. And we read in verse 32 that now while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath. And those who found him gathering the wood, notice where they brought him. They brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. And they put him in custody because they had not been declared what should be done to him. They see a guy violating a law of God, the fourth command, honor the Sabbath day, keep it holy. He's working on that day, and so they grab him up and they take him where? They take him before Moses and Aaron, the leaders, but not just the leaders, before all the congregation, because they don't know what they're supposed to do with this individual. And so the Lord speaks to Moses in verse 35 and says, the man shall surely be put to death. And notice who is given the responsibility of carrying out this judgment from God. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. This responsibility of carrying out the judgment of God was given not just to Moses, not just to Aaron, but to the whole congregation. And again, we see that Israel was faithful in following this command, verse 36. So all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. In fact, it's interesting, as you look at this beginning of the nation of Israel, it becomes very clear that the concept of the whole congregation being responsible for carrying out this type of capital punishment is seen all over the place. For example, in Leviticus chapter 20 and in verse 2, there we're told that you shall say to the sons of Israel, any man of the sons of Israel from the alien sojourning in Israel who gives any of his offspring to Molech. Now, Molech was a pagan god, a false god, an idol. And the way that things were oftentimes offered to Molech, in fact, quite often, it involved sacrificing your child alive by burning them in a fire to this idol. A horrendous, terrible thing. I mean, that's not just idolatry. That's like cruel idolatry in my mind. And the instruction from God is, if anybody is caught doing this, surely he shall surely be put to death. And notice who's responsible for doing it. The people of the land shall stone him with the stones. Not the police, not the army, not the leaders, the people. The community was given that responsibility. In Leviticus chapter 24, we see another instance. This time it's regarding breaking the third command, not taking the name of the Lord your God in vain, blaspheming God. And here God tells them that when somebody does this, verse 14, bring the one who is cursed outside the camp and let all who heard him, notice, lay their hands on his head. That is, those who overheard him speaking evil of God, cursing God, they're to lay their hands on the head of this one, signifying we heard it, we're witnesses. But notice who the responsibility is given. Then let all the congregation stone him. You shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if anyone curses God, then he will bear his sin. Moreover, the one who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him. The alien as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, he shall be put to death. And we see again that the Israelites were faithful. Verse 23, then Moses spoke to the sons of Israel. They brought the one who had cursed outside the camp and stoned him with stones. Thus the sons of Israel did just as the Lord had commanded Moses. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, we see another instance of this same idea. Deuteronomy chapter 17, whenever somebody within the borders of Israel is found guilty of transgressing the law of God, the prescription is you do a thorough investigation, verify the facts, make sure that they actually have done what is wrong, that they've broken the covenant, and then you're to carry out the judgment. They're to be brought out of the gate of the city where the witnesses were to cast the first stones. But notice in verse 7, though the hands of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people, so you shall purge the evil from your midst. And so this responsibility of carrying out the punishment from God is something that is consistently given not to a select few, but to the whole congregation, to all of the people. And while we're here in Deuteronomy, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 29. And notice that after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, when the children of Israel are about to go in and take possession of the promised land, they renew the covenant that their previous generation had received from God at Sinai. This is now a new generation that's grown up. They were all kids when God came down to Sinai and delivered the Ten Commandments. And because of their rebellion related to the 12 spies, they were punished by having to wander in the wilderness 40 years until that whole generation passed away. And so now you have a new generation that are the adults. And they're entering into this covenant again with God. Really, they're renewing the covenant that they had with God. And notice that everyone, it's very explicit here in this text, everyone was present and included in entering into this covenant with God. Notice in verse 10, he says, "You stand today, all of you, before the Lord your God." Well, who is all of you? Well, your chiefs, your tribes, your elders and your officers, even all the men of Israel. But he's not done. Even your little ones, your wives, and the alien who is within your camps, from the one who chops your wood to the one who draws your water, all of you are here that you may enter into the covenant which the Lord your God, with the Lord your God, and into his oath with which the Lord your God is making with you today, in order that he may establish you all today as his people, and that he may be your God, just as he spoke to you and as he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. It was the whole nation of Israel that entered into this covenant relationship with God. They were all a part of the agreement between God and the people. They were all then responsible for carrying out their part and their role within that covenant, making sure that they obeyed the laws and kept the commands so that they would all continue to be God's people. And the responsibility for that work, up to and including the execution of capital punishment against violators, was entrusted and given to all the congregation. But let's look at a couple other things that I think also further illustrate this Old Testament precedent. There is a history among the nation of Israel of people coming and sharing their concerns within the context of the assembly, when the whole congregation is gathered together. We already looked at the instance in Numbers chapter 15 where the guy violated the fourth command and broke the Sabbath. And we saw there that they didn't know what to do about this situation. We know that it's not right to break the Sabbath, that God said honor it, and we see somebody not doing that, but what do we do about that? They have a concern, a question. God, how do you want us to handle this situation? And so what do? They present the situation in the context of an assembly of the entire congregation. They bring the man and their concern to Moses and to Aaron, and to all the congregation. And again there, I'll just remind us that it was the whole congregation who was charged then with carrying out the punishment that God said was to be inflicted upon the one who had sinned. But there's an even more interesting example of a godly concern being presented in the midst of the assembly, and it's found in Numbers chapter 27. Beginning in verse 1, "Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, came near. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahla, Noah, and Hogla, and Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses, and before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders, and all the congregation, at the doorway of the tent of meeting." So I want you to just have this picture in your mind. It was at the doorway of the tent of meeting, at the tabernacle. That was inside the tabernacle, was where the priests would perform the priestly duties, and they'd offer up the sacrifices, and they would present those things to the Lord, and they had the table of showbread and the incense and all of that kind of stuff. But it was at the doorway of the tent of meeting that was where the people would come and assemble to commune with God. So what you have here is a picture of what I believe is a congregational assembly for the means of purpose of worship, or at least to inquire of God, what are we going to do? And it's in this context that these five daughters of Zelophehad come before the congregation and say, verse 3, our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. Normally, inheritance and the land was going to be divided among the male descendants. Well, Zelophehad had no sons. He had five girls. It would seem that his family is going to miss out on receiving a portion of land in the divisions of the promised land. They're not going to get an inheritance. Well, these five daughters of Zelophehad think, why would that have to be the case? And so they go and they present their petition, their concern, to the leaders, to Moses and to Eleazar and the leaders, in the presence of all the congregation. And Moses brought their case before the Lord, verse 5. And notice what the Lord said. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. You shall surely give them a hereditary possession among their father's brothers, and you shall transfer the inheritance of their father to them. Now, to me, this example illustrates a couple of things, at least. Number one, it illustrates the fact that the leaders of Israel were meeting, at the very least, were meeting together to discuss matters in the presence of the entire congregation. But secondly, it makes me realize that sometimes those leaders overlook certain things. They missed this in their efforts to divide the land and give instruction. They made an oversight, so to speak. They missed something. And so this legitimate godly concern is brought to their attention in the context of the congregational meeting, in a congregational setting. But what's really interesting to me about this is that it's brought to them in this group setting by five women. Now, if God was not okay with that, with a woman or these women approaching their leaders in the midst of the assembly and voicing a godly concern, certainly he would have said something about that. He would have said that wasn't the right way to handle it. That wasn't what you ought to have done. But that's not what we find here in the text. What we find here in the text is God saying, Moses, they're right. Their case is just. Their concern and petition is legitimate, and you should grant their request. And what's interesting to me, you can look later on in Numbers chapter 36 or Joshua chapter 7 where this incident is referenced again. And in those places, these women seem to be being held up as an example, a godly example of how it ought to be done. They're not criticized. They're not ridiculed. They're held up as noble examples for what they did on this occasion. There are other examples of important events throughout the beginning of the nation of Israel that clearly illustrate that the whole congregation was involved in what was going on with the nation of Israel. So, for example, in Leviticus chapter 8, when Aaron and his sons are being consecrated as priests to the Lord, they're going to serve in the tabernacle and serve on behalf of the people. It's very interesting to me that we read in verse 4. So Moses did just as the Lord had commanded, and when the congregation was assembled at the doorway of the tent of meeting, Moses said to the congregation, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded to do. And then Moses took Aaron and his sons who came near, and he washed them, and he purifies them, and he consecrates them to be the priests for the nation. But that consecration took place in the presence of the entire congregation of Israel. Again, in Leviticus chapter 9, when the priests are presenting the sin offering on behalf of the people, where are the people? Well, we read in verse 3, the sons of Israel, you shall speak, take a male goat for a sin offering, a calf and a lamb, both one year old, without defect, for a burnt offering, an ox and a ram for peace offerings to sacrifice before the Lord, a grain offering mixed with oil, for today the Lord will appear to you. So they took what Moses had commanded to the front of the tent of meeting, and the whole congregation came near and stood before the Lord. Not just the men, not just the leaders, the whole congregation was there and participating in this act. Yes, it was the priests who offered the sacrifice for them, but they were there. They were present because they were a part of what was going on. In Numbers chapter 8, when the Levites, who were to be those, they weren't necessarily priests, they were from the same family as the priests, but the Levites were the ones who were to tend to the things of the tabernacle. They were the ones who were given the duties of setting up the tent and taking it down and taking care of all the utensils and all of the stuff that was going on within the tabernacle. And when these guys are appointed, just go there with me. Numbers chapter 8. Numbers chapter 8, verses 9 and 10, it says, "So you shall present the Levites before the tent of meeting. You shall also assemble the whole congregation of the sons of Israel and present the Levites before the Lord. And the sons of Israel," notice this, "shall lay their hands on the Levites." What is going on there? Well, again, the Levites were to serve on behalf of the people. And here the people, as they're being dedicated for this work, come together and lay their hands on them as they are being presented before the Lord to do this work on their behalf. If I'm right about my idea of laying on of hands in a non-miraculous sense, it has to do with saying, it's a physical gesture that says, we're in this with you. We're a part of this together. And in this instance, those Levites were doing a great service on behalf of the rest of the congregation. In Numbers chapter 13, when the spies were sent to spy out the land and bring back a report of how it was. And remember, they bring back the large clusters of grapes and they bring back the fruit of the land and they come back and they say the land is really good. Notice who they came and talked to. Numbers chapter 13 and verse 25. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of the 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They didn't just come and talk to Moses. They didn't just come and talk to the leaders. They came and talked to the whole congregation and said, guys, this is what we found in the land. Why? Because it was all the people who were going to go in and take possession of the land. They were a part of what was going on. And one final example in Numbers chapter 27. As Moses is getting older and he's told he's not going to be able to enter the promised land, they need to pick somebody who's going to take up the mantle for him, who's going to lead in his place. And that man was Joshua, the son of Nun. And beginning in verse 15 of Numbers chapter 27, then Moses spoke to the Lord saying, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep who have no shepherd." So the Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the spirit, and lay your hands on him." There again, we see that idea of laying hands on, right? I'm with you, Joshua, in what you're getting ready to do. But notice this. He was to do this. He was to have him stand, verse 19, before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and commission him in their sight. He wanted everybody to know what was going on. And that when Moses is no longer there, who do we look to? You're going to look to Joshua. And he does that in the presence of all the congregation. It wasn't done in a back room behind a closed door. It was done in the presence of the assembly. What we see throughout the Old Testament precedent is the consistent involvement the participation and engagement of the whole congregation of Israel in entering into and then carrying out the mission and the work of the nation of Israel, the Old Testament church. Now, there's one more aspect of Old Testament precedent that lies behind the New Testament pattern, which I would like to share with you, but we don't have time today. And so next week, I will share that with you. And once we've finished laying out the Old Testament precedent, we'll then examine the New Testament pattern that I believe clearly illustrates and substantiates with New Testament authority what I asserted at the beginning of the lesson, that it is the whole congregation who is charged with the responsibility of carrying out the work of the church.